What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Arnies. We are three guys anxious for space travel to become commonplace so we can visit planets with black and white aesthetics. God, can't wait. I'm Matt Johnson, and I'd be curious to meet Austin Butler's dialect coach. Who is this person?
I'm Keith Baker, and let's face it, guys. People with the spice blue eyes, they just look better.
And I'm Austin Terry, and I need Javier Bardem to follow me around as my own personal hype man.
I love that. That's kind of a dream, I feel like. God, that's the dream. On today's show, of course, we are back on Arrakis for Dune Part 2. A couple weeks ago, Austin and I did a revisit of Part 1 to get prepped, and were pleasantly surprised that we liked it even more this time around. And kind of the realization that Part 2 is coming up real soon, was like just weeks away and not months, was so exciting. Super sweet. And Keith, I know you just rewatched Part 1, so I want to know, how is the rewatch before we kind of get into anything here?
I think I'm on the same page as you guys. I loved the rewatch. And watching with subtitles definitely helped.
The subtitles are key. I already can't wait to watch Part 2 with subtitles.
Yeah, picked up all the... some of the lore that I did not catch before, some of the house names, and then just little stuff that just slipped through the cracks for me the first time. And then I think I just appreciated a lot of the visuals, the soundtrack, and then the performances as well. So it got me so pumped up to see the second one.
Yeah, me too. It was wild. And I feel like we're not the only ones. I've been listening to some other people, and they've kind of echoed the same sentiments. They were like, yeah, I watched Dune Part 1 when it came out on HBO Max years ago, and it was like, it was good. Like, I liked it. Maybe I was hoping for a bit more. I was confused, or I just feel like I missed a lot. But people are rewatching it ahead of this, and I keep hearing, like, holy shit, Dune rocks. Like, it is, like, such a weird, I don't know what happened, but something, maybe, I guess we all had COVID. We had, like, long, we had long-term complications. We just, like, weren't prepared to watch Dune Part 1, forgetting everything in real time. But yeah, I'm totally with you. Watching it again, I was like, holy shit, this movie rocks. And I got so excited. And I don't know. Austin, is there anything you want to say before we get into like non-spoiler thoughts on Part 2? I feel like this is an episode where we got to get to our non-spoilers quick because there's going to be so much to talk about. But I want to give you room to talk about your rewatch a couple weeks ago, kind of your hype levels going into this and how it all went down.
Yeah, I think the only thing I'd add is it's crazy how Dune Part 2 kind of snuck up on everybody. A part of that's the writer strike and how many times it was moved. But like, this is the biggest movie of the year, and there is almost no hype for it until the week of the release. And this is like, I mean, I'll just go straight into my non-spoiler thoughts. This is a cinematic masterpiece. This is one of the best movies I've ever seen in my life. And it kind of like flew under the radar until it came out and the early reviews are so incredible. And I don't have anything to say about it other than things that are already out there, but it's a masterpiece. You got to see it in theaters. I haven't had this experience in theaters since seeing Endgame. It's a reason to go see the movies this year. I mean, everything about it, the scores, the visual, everything's on another level. It benefits so much from Dune Part 1 having already existed and kind of laid that groundwork for everyday people to come into the Dune universe, despite how dense that book is, and kind of have a base understanding of the lore. It's everything you want Star Wars to be and so much more. It's incredible. I loved every second of it. I can't wait for it to come to Max so I can watch it again. I might go see it again in theaters. It's like hands down one of the best films I've seen in years and already the best of 2024 for sure.
Yeah, I'm with you, Austin. This is probably one of the best movies I've seen in theaters in a long time. I'm just excited for this, the lore behind this. Like I'm kind of tired of Star Wars. I'm tired of Marvel. We need something new sci-fi wise. And I think they really brought it to the table with Dune.
It's so exciting to watch a new franchise be built out in theaters because we've kind of everything else kind of is stale at this point. So this is thrilling.
Yeah, it's just cool to have something new besides Star Trek, Star Wars, DC, whatever you want to throw out there. But yeah, I had a great time. The action, all the characters that were in the first one that came back, killed it again. And all the new performances that we got or new actors and actresses that we got in there, I also killed their roles as well. And then just being on this desert planet and seeing how the worms work even more, how the houses work, how the emperor works, just figuring out everything. It was just so much fun to watch it play out. So, yeah, I can't wait for Part 3.
Yeah, just to jump off that, Keith, I think the best thing I can say about Dune Part 2 is I'm kind of with you. I'm excited to watch it when it comes to Max. I might, like Austin said, I might go see it in theaters again as well. But I think the crowning achievement in a weird way is that I definitely missed a lot. And it's not for lack of trying. I was very invested, but there's just so much dialogue. There's so much visual storytelling. They're often happening at the exact same time. So one viewing, you're going to miss things. But while that was kind of a negative I had for part one, for this, I was like actively watching it. There was a few moments where I was like, oh, I missed that. But I was still in it. And I still would call this like just an exceptional movie. Like I loved it. And you're right. I think it's not super interesting anymore. I feel like to say that things like Marvel and Star Wars are played out. Disney and Disney Plus especially kind of added fuel to that fire. But I'm with you. It is really great to just see an original property, one that has had a lasting legacy, kind of be turned not only into a franchise, because whenever you say franchise now, sometimes that kind of comes with a negative connotation. But it's just really cool to see a filmmaker truly at the peak of his career. And he's still so young with Denis Villeneuve. I mean, it's still crazy to me that in back-to-back years, this guy did Prisoners, Enemy, Sicario, Arrival, Blade Runner 2049. That was back-to-back years. And then he's like, you know
and
what?
And that was all just a warm-up for Dune.
Exactly. And then he's like, I got to take a few years off now because I got to cook with Dune. And then he did that and then did the same thing here. The passion's on screen. And yes, this is turning into a franchise to my point. But there is so much more just passion and innovation and just like cinematic achievement, I feel like, here than we get anywhere else. That doesn't mean that we need it everywhere else. It doesn't have to be in everything, but it's just great to get something as unique and special as this. What a movie. I had a great time. And I've only been thinking about it more ever since seeing it the other night. So I can't wait to talk about it with you guys.
We'll probably go very quickly into spoilers, but I guess we should just give like a general, like, this is the movie to go see in theaters. The scale, the sound designs, the way just things move up on the big screen. Like, this is what movie theaters are made for. If anyone is still hesitant to go back to a theater,
yeah,
it's worth it for Dune Part 2. It's incredible.
I agree. And with that, I think, like Austin said, let's just drop a spoiler warning now. If you're somebody that has not seen Dune Part 2 yet, please go check it out in the theater first, then come on back and listen to the rest of this episode. Obviously, the three of us have given it a glowing recommendation. Everybody else is too. So definitely go see it. If for some reason you're starting this episode, maybe you haven't seen part one and you're just kind of listening to this and like, should I listen to part one? I mean, definitely go watch part one, then watch part two. I guess what I'm saying is go watch all of Dune, part one and part two, and then listen to the rest of this episode.
And if you haven't seen part one yet, I almost envy you because now you get to watch part one and immediately watch part two and not have to wait 4 years for it.
There you go. Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, officially from this point on, we're going to be full spoilers. It's going to be a great conversation. So let's just get into it. All right, everybody, welcome to spoiler territory for Dune Part 2. And we always, you know, guys, sometimes I wonder if we should move our cast, crew, and critical reception talk to our non-spoiler section. But then you get something like today, where you might get some spoilers in the cast and crew section. So it's kind of made for something like this. So before we get to our kind of roundtable discussion, just our freeform discussion, we're going to talk about like all the details, everything we want to dive into. Let's do some cast and crew talk, please.
All right. So Dune Part 2 is, of course, directed by Denis Villeneuve. And that already ran you through his filmography. But of course, true. Enemy, Prisoner, Sicario, Arrival, Blade Runner 2049, Dune Part 1, and now, of course, Dune Part 2. The film is also written by Villeneuve and John Spates. And our score is composed by the one and only legendary Hans Zimmer. And of course, based on Dune by Frank Herbert. This is the second part of his original book that inspired everything sci-fi we know and love today. So it's so cool to see kind of the original sci-fi epic finally make it to the big screen in the kind of version and tale it deserves, not that crappy stuff from the 80s and the early 2000s TV shows.
All right, going to our cast, we have Timothy Chalamet as Paul Atreides, Zendaya as Shani, Rebecca Ferguson as Lady Jessica, Josh Brolin as Gurney Halleck, Austin Butler as Fade Rotha, Florence Pugh as Princess Irelan, Dave Bautista returning as Glossy Robin, Christopher Walken as Emperor Shaddam IV, Leah Seydoux as Margot Fenring, Charlotte Rampling as Gauss Helen Moheim, and we got Stellan Skarsgård returning as Baron Harkonnen, and Javier Bardem as Stilgar, and you have a surprise, Anya Taylor-Joy, and there is Aleia Atreides. All right, guys, there's our long cast and crew. Any positives, any negatives, what do we got?
It's so hard. I mean, everybody is a highlight. There's nobody giving a bad performance here. My highlight, I'll give it to Denis Villeneuve. Like Matt said at the beginning, it is so exciting to watch a filmmaker at his peak still bringing hits to the big screen. This is kind of how it felt when Christopher Nolan was in his heyday. Same with Tarantino. It's so exciting to have kind of another guy of that caliber back. And as Matt said, still so young and so many other cool projects in the works. And at the end of this film, I mean, people were standing and clapping in my theater, like a standing ovation.
Yeah,
I haven't seen that in years. So it's still so cool to just kind of see the guy at his peak, and like everything about this is firing on all cylinders. I was reading that he storyboarded some of the scenes from this movie when he was in high school, so he's always dreamed about this movie and really stuck to his vision. Everything about it's incredible.
Yeah, I would second everything you just said. Like you said, it's hard to pick a true highlight here. I mean, there's everybody was so good in it. But if I had to pick one, just to pick one, not because they stood out more than the others, I'll shout out Zendaya as Shani. I've liked her character really, you know, we don't get really any dialogue from her in the first one besides the future flashes that we see. So seeing her character develop in the second one was really cool to watch. And I think Zendaya really killed the performance. I like the character, the character of Shani and the way it's written. I think there's some crazy things to come with her character.
And she also has a tough role as Shani of kind of being almost the naysayer to Paul Atreides. And in this movie, like, Paul Atreides is so charismatic and charming. Like, you kind of want everyone to be in his camp. But she has the tough role of walking that line of being his lover, but then also kind of having doubts about if he truly should go into being all in on being the one. And having a character like be that kind of person with all the doubts and not get annoying, it's sometimes a tough line to play. But Zendaya nailed it perfectly. She was... it was so easy to root for her in this movie, despite the fact that she's kind of actively working against your hero in some scenes, too.
Yeah, well, that kind of leads to the whole hero versus villain conversation that I think we're obviously going to have to get to later, you know, especially by the end of the movie, who kind of is the one filling that role. And I think Achani, at least for me, becomes even more heroic as the story goes on, you might say. But yeah, you guys left the door open for me. Of course, before I get to my cast highlight, I know it's the easy Dune joke, but without hyper, I mean, everybody behind the scenes, whether you're Denis Villeneuve, the director kind of at the head of this, or you're just somebody in like the visual department, you're the sound department, you're on set, you know, whatever you're doing, you guys were literally high on spice because you killed it. Like Hans Zimmer must have had like just... he was covered in spice. Like, he knocked it out of the fucking park. They all did. Everybody behind the scenes, kudos to you. But like I said, you left the door open. Every person that watched this guy on Nickelodeon Disney Channel, and then we're like, holy shit, that guy's going to play Elvis. And we're like, that movie fucking blows. And I hate what he's doing with his voice. Austin Butler walked onto Dune Part 2 and said, everybody hates me as Elvis, but I'm going to do something right now. And he killed it. Oh, my God. Keith was like, nobody kind of steals the show over anybody else. And I kind of agree with that. But I also kind of feel like Austin Butler may have stolen the show. I thought he was exceptional. I don't know whose choice it was. I was talking about, like, I want to meet that dialect coach. I don't know whose choice. Was it a Denis choice? Was it an Austin Butler choice? Was it somebody behind the scenes, like, working on, like, dialects and voice? But the decision for him to sound exactly like Stellan Skarsgård and then to follow through with that was, I don't know, dude. It was
And
perfect.
He sounds like him, too. It doesn't
he
sound fake.
He sounded exactly like him. It was unnerving. But yeah, that's the performance that I was most riveted by watching this. And that's on top of everybody else that was already like at the top of their game.
It is so jarring watching him in Masters of the Air airing at the same time as Dune, because he looks drastically different in this movie. It's crazy, that transformation.
All right, guys. Well, let's get into critical reception. Is there any point to do this? Maybe not, because shocker, we're not alone in loving this. Everybody else did. Dune Part 2 has received critical acclaim and has a 94% on Rotten Tomatoes. The site's critical consensus is visually thrilling and narratively epic. Dune Part 2 continues Denis Villeneuve's adaptation of the beloved sci-fi series in spectacular form. It's so good that they didn't make a shitty pun that we always make fun of. This one cost $190 million to make, which is like $25 million more, I want to say, than Dune Part 1.
Yeah, Dune Part 1 was $165.
And if I actually had to update my numbers here, it looks like internationally opening weekend, we're looking at around $175 million. So basically, in an opening weekend, they've just about recouped the production cost. So anything going forward, they're well on their way to not only breaking even, but kind of smashing not only the Dune Part 1 numbers, but a lot of numbers. So Dune Messiah, Dune, aka Dune Part 3, I think you might be guaranteed to happen.
The only thing I want to focus in here, Matt, is the budget, because you and I have talked about this a little bit, but Dune Part 2, $190 million to make. Dune Part 1, $165 million. That means $355 to make both Dune movies. And Ridley Scott's Gladiator 2, its budget just ballooned to $300 million
plus. Austin already said earlier, like, you know, we've already gotten what might be the best movie of the year, and we're just barely into March. Ridley Scott must be... Well, I was going to say he must be shaking in his boots, but I think after our Napoleon review, Austin, we know that Ridley Scott isn't one to really shake in his boots. I don't think he cares about any of this. He's like, whatever, I'm putting out a movie called Gladiator 2 later this year. It cost me a small fortune, and it won't make its money.
I just can't wait for my now yearly annual holiday season Ridley Scott angry press tours.
God.
Because nobody's seeing his latest movie.
Love that guy. All right, guys. Well, let's just go ahead and get into it. Let's get into our freeform discussion, the main part of our show where all of us just kind of opened up a Google Doc. We dropped in some random points, could be big or small, just things that we want to dive more deeply into. So I don't know. Is there kind of like a good starting off point, you think?
I want to start really broad with just kind of a general statement that's been on my mind, but a lot of times we talk about, like, what was it like for the people back in the 80s when they first got to go see Star Wars for the first time in theaters and kind of have, like, this whole world opened up to them. Keith, your dad is a huge Star Wars fan. I can only imagine that seeing this movie in theaters is exactly like what that feeling must have first been for everybody that got to see Star Wars as a kid and just kind of have, like, their imagination shattered of, like, what could possibly be put the film, because this movie was so awe-inspiring to see in the theaters.
It's kind of like, is this going to be one of those history in the making moments from our generation? I feel like it is. That's just the feeling I got after rewatching the first one on Thursday and then going to the theater for this one on Friday. I'm like, this is something new that's like working. Like this is badass. Like I'm not getting that feeling from like almost anything else. Like it's harder to even describe. Like after we got out of the theater, Matt and I usually go get a drink after. I think we both were just like so tired. Not because of how long it was, but just because there was so much to process. It was like it was a full-on, crazy, entertaining experience where you're just hooked the whole time.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is going to be that for a lot of people. And the idea of, you know, Denis Villeneuve talking about, you know, making one more and then closing out his Dune trilogy, it does, you know, it's hard not to compare it to something like Star Wars. And it is that never-ending cycle of, well, the book came out, you know, long before Star Wars, and obviously that inspired Star Wars, and now Star Wars is inspiring a movie version of a book that came before it. So it's that weird, never-ending, like, closed-loop type deal. But I have to imagine that, like, I don't know if it's not even, like, a young person thing anymore. Whenever, like, you hear people talk about Star Wars, seeing it in theaters at that age, it seems like it's usually very young people. At least that's my perception. They were young at the time, maybe even kids, and they saw it, and it kind of changed their perception, to your point. But I think with Dune, I'm not like comparing it or like saying one's better than the other. That's not really the point. I'm just saying it seems like for people of all ages, it's kind of doing that same thing. Because it did it for me, and I'm almost 30. It's like it kind of gave me that feeling again. It is, and yeah, to Keith's point, there is like an exhausting nature of like, I just, with these two movies back to back, got introduced to an entirely new world. And I think the fact that it somehow feels realistic, like it could happen, also is this weird like experience. It's just I don't know what an experience. And I think for a lot of people, Dune will be kind of 20 years from now, like they refer to it the same way that we referred to Star Wars when we were younger.
Probably for a lot of future filmmakers too, who are going to be like, man, the first time I saw Dune, I knew I wanted to make movies. For like, this is going to inspire a whole new generation of filmmakers too. Let's jump into the actual film now. I want to start with kind of just our intro first hour. For being such a large galactic scale movie, and you do feel the galactic scale in this film. For me, I would say certainly more than the first one. But were you surprised how we still stay pretty small scale for our intro, and it's really kind of just a small resistance squadron type story for the first hour or so?
I like that about it. I liked that. A large part of this movie, really, they took their time really just establishing and directly continuing, I guess, you know, the whole Fremen storyline and Paul and technically Lady Jessica as well, joining that crew and how they might fit in. Like, it is like a weird, not coming of age, but I suppose an outsider story. Like, I mean, they call them outsiders, but that was like, it was really entertaining to kind of see just, you know, people that wouldn't be with the Fremen kind of discover their ways. And then we as the audience get to watch how the Fremen operate. And yeah, you get so many like endearing sequences. You get so many cool lore moments. I love the scene with Stilgar talking about like Jamis's body, like the water being removed from it and then adding it to this like completely filled like underground basin, I guess. And you find
aquifer.
Out, right. It's like this aquifer and like the only water in it is water from, you know, the dead Fremen for like generations. Like, wow. So you get like endearing moments, like funny moments. You get like those lore moments, but you also get fucking sick action. I got to say, I mean, that opening where they're like Paul and Lady Jessica are kind of just like, you know, like fucking around basically. Like, we don't know what to do. And then it's just the Fremen fighting the Harkonnens on top of that like Mesa type deal was such a cool action sequence. Like, you get so much in this first hour,
especially with the bodies falling off the cliff.
Oh my god,
the sound design of their thuds was amazing. It like made me jump every time.
Yeah, but yeah, to your point about like the Fremen, it was cool just watching how the Fremen are not like, they don't fear the desert as everybody else does. They use it. They use like everything's a tool to them in the desert.
Yeah, they even say if you want to understand the Fremen, you have to understand the desert. And that could have just been a cheap, like, throwaway line, but they kind of earn that line, too, whenever you get to spend more time with their culture and how, like, to your point, Keith, everything they do relates back to the desert. And it's how they kind of turn the tide on the Harkonnens, too. Like, the way they can hide themselves in the sand and they can survive out there. Yeah. And the Harkonnens have these, like, crazy bulky suits that they can't move as fast because they don't know how to adapt. Like, everything about them, like, for the Fremen, the desert is their advantage. And it was really cool to see that, especially when they are kind of doing the guerrilla tactics on the Harkonnens, like spice operations.
I think also the first hour is great. I know something Austin and I were wondering when we did a revisit is, you know, it is a weird concept of Zendaya playing Chani in the first one, just in kind of these dream sequences, and then has some opening narration, but then really gets no characterization or anything of not value, but just anything substantial until like basically the last 5 minutes of part one. And then it's like, how are we going to go from this to a complete 180 where they're now the co-lead of the movie? And I think the first hour did an absolutely great job of like, you know, Zendaya obviously does a great job performance wise, but also the writing really props up that character. And so like, not only are you getting introduced to such a fascinating character, but I just think the chemistry between her and Timothée Chalamet was also great. And just kind of establishing that very naturally in the first hour was important, because I know Austin already mentioned, I mean, becomes a big deal later. I mean, Chani's really kind of the moral opposition to Paul as the movie goes on, kind of the only one, if you think about it. So it's a very important character narratively as well. So yeah, just great, you know, first hour setting all that up, and like their love story is actually quite believable despite being almost a non-factor in the first movie.
Yeah, let's dive into the religious factions in this movie. You, of course, have it all centers around Paul, who is the one, the prophet, or supposed to be at least. You have someone like Stilgar, who is a fundamentalist and is fully bought in to Paul. And like I joked in the intro, is like the ultimate hype man for Paul in this movie. You have someone like Zendaya, who believes that a Fremen and not an outsider can only be the prophet, and the Fremen have to save themselves. And then you have Lady Jessica and her organization, the Bene Gesserit, who are kind of more propagandist and are there kind of stoking the flames. And of course, Lady Jessica is bending things to her own needs and her own desires to get Paul, to get the Fremen to believe that Paul is the one. So how did all that work for you? Was it hard to follow, or did they kind of flow naturally in this movie?
Yeah, I would say it all worked for me. Not so much hard to follow, but maybe just more confused by the motives of the Atreides family as a whole with Lady Jessica and Paul. Those two were what seemed like were on the same page in the first one. And then going into the second one here, they're clearly not on the same page, but kind of on the same page in the background, where I was like, are they trying to get to the same goal here? Or are they really just seeing things in an entirely different light altogether? And then you have Paul, like you said, Austin, he has this perfect chemistry with Chani, and he's really like digging his life with the Fremens now. And like he feels like he has a purpose. But then in the background, he's supposed to be the prophet, the one. And she's just like not in on that at all.
She just doesn't believe it.
Yeah, she doesn't believe it. Whereas, like you said, Stilgar, he's like the complete opposite. Like he's all in. And then Stilgar has his followers who are all like, yes, Stilgar's right. Paul is the prophet, and we need to follow Paul. And then Paul just starts believing that, I guess he has more like a chip on his shoulder now. He's like, oh yeah, that's right. Like, I am this prophet. I am the one. My dad, you know, told me that the Atreides name would, you know, would have to live on and carry on the legacy and all that. So yeah, it was just like, I can't tell like what these people want.
I think when it comes to what Paul wants is really interesting, because at the end of the day, Paul wants revenge for the death of his father. He even says that at the beginning.
He does.
And I think he is still bought into the prophecy, but I think he is on the same page with his mother for the most part. I think the only part where they differ is he wants to use the prophecy to prop the Fremen up and allow them to kind of discover their own way. And then he gets his hand kind of gets forced and he has to go south by Fade. He does have to then go drink the water of life. And then when he sees all these options, I think the only path he sees forward to like the people he cares about surviving is by buying into being the one. So I think his hand kind of gets forced. But I do think originally he was not fully bought in on himself being the prophet, like he says a lot. And he did want to use that prophecy to help the Fremen prop themselves up.
Completely agree. In the first hour, he's very adamant that he doesn't really care about the prophecy. He really just wants to learn the ways of the Fremen. I think he's kind of accepted, well, my family's gone, so this is our life now. I'm just going to buy into this. And if I can help the Fremen, like, have a better life, if that means, like, fighting the Harkonnens, I'll do that. But it's not about the prophecy, and I'm totally with you. Like, what Paul wants in this movie, I think, is the most interesting thing about it. And I love the way the delivery and also the writing of whenever he has the Water of Life, he describes, like, the possibility. He, like, moves his hand and he says it's a very narrow way forward. He found a path. So it's very, he's basically saying it's very specific what I have to do to, like, lead the Fremen to the promised land, this paradise that he has a dream about, where Anya Taylor-Joy is like, hey, I'm like one of the biggest actresses in the world. I'll do a cameo and then be in your next movie. But seeing that scene of, like, you know, the sands leading into the ocean, kind of this promised land, this paradise, Arrakis can be that. But I mean, the most fascinating thing is now it's like, and the reason he's like against Chani is like, in order to get the Fremen, the people that I actually care about, to this promised land, part of this narrow path is I do have to challenge the seat of emperor. I do have to marry Florence Pugh, the princess, and maybe start a family line with her, I guess. And like, somehow that starts the holy war that he described as billions of lives will be lost. But then it's somehow that's going to circle back around to doing all of this will actually lead the Fremen and Arrakis to the promised land. But there's quite a lot of consequences to doing that. And that's what makes the motivation, like, intriguing, but also scary. There's certainly an argument to be made that Paul becomes the villain at the end. I think there's also a cut of this movie. If you watch it without context, you would go, Lady Jessica is the villain of this movie. Like, you know, like, there's arguments to be made. And that's what makes it so, like, hard to deal with. Like, to your point, Keith, like, every character wants something different. But at the same time, they're also kind of the same thing. It's very bizarre to describe.
It's so cool to see a movie, like, commit to that path too. I feel like a lot of other films would have like teased Paul ascending to emperor and possibly becoming the villain, but then found like a last minute ditch effort for him to get out of it and still stay like the good hero. But to like fully commit to it, trigger the holy war, send the Fremen out on his kind of crusade that he triggers against the great houses, it's such a fascinating setup for the next movie. And I think you're right, Matt. I think at the end of this film, Paul is setting up to become the villain of the third movie, especially because he will be the all-powerful emperor. And what we know about sci-fi movies, the emperor is always the bad guy. So I'm excited to see what that looks like, too, especially from someone like Chani's perspective.
Yeah, and they're also playing with the idea that, I mean, look at actual history. It's like messiahs are, you know, some are, but they're not all. They may be considered messiahs, but that doesn't mean that they're considered heroic or loved by all. I think there's a very real possibility that by the end of Dune Part 3, Paul does lead them all to the promised land, but maybe he dies in the process or he's not, like, loved. Like, maybe they go, like, yeah, you're the messiah, you brought us to this place, but we can't accept, like, the way you got us here. And maybe that's what he would have to accept as this chosen one. Like, maybe that's the consequence. I don't know.
Well, and it's important to keep in mind that Dune was written, and it's supposed to be a warning against messianic figures. So Paul becoming that messiah is not supposed to be a positive thing for anybody involved.
I was so confused by Lady Jessica's story the whole time, too. She gets the blue eyes, she gets the spice eyes, and now she's seeing all these things. She even has tattoos in her face now. the Fremen are propping up Paul, but now they're propping up her too. It's like, why are they propping up her? Is this now she's like all of a sudden in a leadership position?
It's also important to keep in mind that Stilgar propped her up, and Stilgar was very bought into the prophecy, and the prophecy is a Reverend Mother will bring the one. So it's easy for Stilgar to buy in because he's kind of creating his own self-fulfilling prophecy, because he's setting events in motion that will make it seem like Paul is the one, just like Lady Jessica's doing the same thing. So you kind of have Stilgar and Lady Jessica. I think Stilgar really does care about the Fremen. Lady Jessica is just using them as a means to an end, but they are still kind of doing the exact same thing where they're creating their own self-fulfilling ideas. That way it's so easy for them to pitch Paul as the one to the Fremen.
I think they even say at the beginning, like, I think the reason Stilgar goes even more full, like, on board with Paul is, like, the Lisan al-Ghaib, you know, the chosen one for the Fremen. I think it was even as specific as the Lisan al-Ghaib will come, and their mother will become our Reverend Mother. And, like, the process of becoming Reverend Mother is so, like drinking the water of life can kill you. So then when she doesn't die, that's when Stilgar's like, oh, shit. Like, he's definitely the Lisan al-Ghaib now, if, like, she survived that. But it kind of goes to your point, Keith, and like to what you were saying, Austin, as well. It's like, I think Lady Jessica's motivation is extremely fascinating because it's quite possible that she has just been, you know, risen as the Bene Gesserit. She's heard this prophecy her entire life. But she also, we watch her in the movie make moves to ensure it happens. So it's like, you can tell yourself, like, that prophecy could have never been real. It could have just been an old story, but you are making it reality through the moves that you're making by convincing these weaker minded people or even children to believe in Paul. And then you kind of forced Paul's hand to do it. So it's that whole interesting thing of like this prophecy, to Chani's point, could have not been real. Like, we've become slaves to this prophecy and you're ensuring it happens. Then by the movie, the end of the movie, it does. So it's like, and I think Austin already kind of mentioned this. I think the important thing to remember, and I'm so glad they seeded this in like the opening minutes of the movie, basically, is, and you kind of forget it as the movie goes on, but you're kind of watching Paul resist being the chosen one. And then, of course, he accepts it and then embraces that title. I think the thing that makes Paul an intriguing chosen one archetype is like he is fulfilling these roles. He is saying at least out loud that he wants to lead them to paradise. He wants to help these people. He wants to be the prophet that they've talked about, that they think he is. But they see it in the beginning that Paul still wants revenge for the death of his father and like the House Atreides, basically. So there is still like a push and pull. Like there's an argument. It's like, is Paul fully in on this, or in the back of his head, is he still just doing this, like kind of willing to trigger a holy war, willing to get close to the Emperor just because he wants to fucking kill him because he said, kill Leto Atreides? There is an argument there, too. And that's to your point of like, what's real, what isn't, like how involved is the spice? I'm glad they seeded in that Paul wanted revenge at the beginning, because I think there's an argument that he's just talking the talk because he wants to kill the Harkonnens.
I think there totally is, too. Even if you go back to the first movie, his original plan was to go to the Emperor and offer his hand in marriage to his daughter and unite the houses. And what does he do at the end of this movie? He takes his daughter's hand in marriage. So he is still enacting the plan that he set in motion even before he like had that internal debate about accepting his role as the prophet or not. I will say, though, I loved that the plan worked like 100%. There was no like, oh no, we started our plan and it kind of faltered. Like everything Paul set in motion executed like to perfection to a T. The second those nukes drop and they start their assault on the Emperor's fortress, it goes to perfection. Like it was so cool to see, and it was flawless, and it was so fun to watch play out too.
And it's also cool that like now you have the argument that Paul can see like all these futures, and he's picked the one, the narrow path, as he described it, as like, you know, this is the way forward. Whenever things seemingly don't work out, you can kind of just now say, well, that's the plan. It has to not work out now. It's going to work out later. Like whenever Gurney's like, Paul, you know, the houses are all here. The great houses are all here. They just said that they reject you as the new emperor. And Paul just says, he doesn't look mad. He just goes, all right, well, we'll lead them to paradise. And then the holy war starts. And it's like,
that line was so good.
I know. He's like, I guess them rejecting him as emperor is part of the plan for him to eventually, you know, it's part of the path he's walking. So, you know, yeah. I don't know. But yeah, holy shit. Like that the whole third act kind of like, oof, just good stuff in there. But we were talking about, you know, who's the villain, who's not. I think we got to talk about you know, the actual on paper villains of this movie. It's hard not to. We get more Stellan Skarsgård. And then we get the brothers. We have Dave Bautista back. And then we have Elvis himself, Austin Butler. And we have some other villains there as well. I mean, I guess technically.
How dare you? Don't you mean Sergeant Buck Holloway?
Yeah, I love, of course. Oh, Sergeant Buck. I haven't watched it. But but then, yeah, also you have like the main Reverend Mother played by Charlotte Rampling. Lots of villains. So what should we talk about with kind of this crew here? Our ne'er-do-wells, if you will.
I mean, I think Dave Bautista has cemented himself as the best wrestler turned actor. He was already separating himself from the other two, but I mean, his range in this movie is incredible, especially if you watch him in Guardians too. Like, to go from playing Drax to playing Harkonnen, like just a despicable guy. And then also, like, when you're kissing the boots and things aren't going well for him, you're kind of like, man, Dave's in a tough spot in this movie. I kind of feel a little bad for him, especially when Austin Butler gets more involved. So I thought he was just fun to watch kind of stomp around. I also loved whenever Paul is walking through the sand towards him with his army, when they first encounter each other, he turns and run. Like, at his heart, he's kind of a coward. Mm. I thought that was so satisfying to see.
And it wasn't his choice to leave Arrakis in the first place, to swap it out for the Atreides. Like, he was, from everything we've heard, he was doing great, like, in terms of spice production. But then the Emperor was like, well, we have to kill the Atreides, so we're going to, like, pull the Harkonnens out, put the Atreides on, kill them, and then put the Harkonnens back. And then that's when he starts not doing his job up to snuff. So it is interesting going from playing the big brute in the first one to playing, frankly, a pathetic character in this one. And I think Dave Bautista kind of nailed that characterization. If I'm going to levy a minor criticism at the movie, I do not think in any way, shape, or form they earned the Gurney Halleck and Robin, like, rivalry. Because, I mean, Austin, you and I joked whenever we did our revisit, it is funny in part one whenever Gurney is like fighting the Harkonnens whenever they show up and he goes, "With me, men!" And then he just runs out into the fire and then you never see him again in the movie. And then you just see him playing the guitar in this one. And then, like, the entire movie, he's talking about, like, Rabin gave me this scar. And then whenever he sees him, he's like walking up in slow motion. We're supposed to care. Like, they never shared a scene in the first one. So
yeah, Gurney unfortunately got the edit. He got the cut. Those scenes are filmed. We'll never see him. But it would have been cool to kind of get those extra 15 minutes.
Agreed. But yeah, whenever Austin Butler comes in, Fade Rotha, such a fun villain to watch. And to your point of, like, they never make them good. It's fun just to see a villain be a villain. There's nothing redeeming about this character. And their introduction, holy shit, the black and white sequence on Getty Prime.
That design is incredible. The way the fireworks look like liquidy was so cool.
There was that one scene that I hated to do it, but I had to. I was comparing it to Star Wars. It's whenever the gladiator type scene, the arena scene. Oh. Baron gets wheeled out like he's Jabba the Hutt and he's like overlooking, like,
it's probably where George Lucas got that idea from. He probably read it in Dune.
Oh.
Yeah. It was almost like to a T, like a mix between like the pod racing and Phantom Menace and then the Geonosis scene in Attack of the Clones, like the gladiator type stuff. I thought that was funny.
Yeah.
Because Baron was like this Jabba the Hutt type character.
That's a good point. Yeah, it was exactly that. But yeah, what a sequence. I think that might, in terms of like a visual, that could be, it's hard. I mean, of course, like whenever Paul first rides the sandworm of all sandworms, that was pretty fucking sick. But I mean, the black and white sequence might be my number one. But then also, I mean, I'm a sucker for a one-on-one fight. And the Fade Rotha versus Paul fight at the end with no music, their knife fight was unbelievable.
And also, like, kind of the same way the first movie ended. Just a very small-scale fight. But yeah, that choreography was incredible. The way they were twisting with how fast it was. Like, there was no way to cut it and make it seem janky. Like, they kind of just, one frame, they let it play out. It was so cool and just fun to watch. Everything about this movie is cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, that last fight scene, that was incredible to watch. Like you said, Matt, with no music, it made it even, better. And then that one part, like at the very end, like Paul's already been stabbed and then Austin Butler's knife is just like kind of scraping his chest as he's trying to hold it back. I was like, oh, God.
Well, he does the thing that you always cringe at when you see movies is like Paul's about to get stabbed and he just grabs his knife with his hand to try and stop it. So it's like obviously cutting his hand. But yeah, that was sick. But I mean, that entire final sequence and that, I guess I don't know if throne room's the right word. It's the same room that we saw Oscar Isaac and Gurney in the first movie where they're looking out across the city. But I mean, Keith, I don't know about you, but I feel like that's where we got the most like vocalizations from the audience, because that's also the scene where, ugh, Paul, you know what? I know you have moves to make, but you're not doing yourself any favors when it comes to Chani whenever you go like, I'll love you until my last breath. And then the next thing you say is you like trying to marry Florence Pugh across the room.
Dude, audible gasps. Yeah, from the audience
gasped at that. But and I turned the moment in the movie that like made me out loud turn to Keith and go, that was fucking sick. And it was also the moment where
he uses the voice on the senior Bene Gesserit lady.
He said silence to the person that was that said silence to him in part one and then forced his hand in the box. Like,
and also her line when she goes, abomination.
Oh, so good. And I mean, all that stuff happened in the same sequence. It was like, sorry, Chani. And then also the voice being used for like one of the few times in the movie. And then the Fade Rotha fight that all happened back to back. It was insane.
Dude, the second those nukes drop, it is nonstop full speed to the credits. It's great.
So, yeah, guys, I mean, is there anything else? I mean, we know at this point, based on the money this is making, I think, you know, Denis Villeneuve's already said that he's almost done writing Dune, which, I assume it's going to be called Dune Part 3, but it's going to be based on the entirety of the book, Dune Messiah.
Sounds like he's calling it Dune Messiah.
Oh, okay. So there you go. So whatever it is, like, so Dune Messiah, we know that will be the end of his trilogy, and then he won't be doing any more. And he said that he doesn't want them to adapt any of the future stuff because it's really kind of jumps the shark. We also know Hans Zimmer has also started writing music for it. So he's got that spice back in hand and he's just tossing it in his face as he's writing the music. But yeah, what do you guys want to talk about? Like, I mean, any theories? Is there anything specific that you'd want to see based on how this one ends? Because this movie really basically ends with like a shot of like Lady Jessica going, the holy war is about to begin. And then Chani kind of walks off and is like looking distraught. So we could go anywhere.
So I'll give a big warning to the audience listening that I know a little bit about Dune Messiah, which is the second book. So if you don't want to know anything about potentially what Dune Part 3 is about, maybe stop listening here. So we'll say that there in caveat. But I do know Dune Messiah takes place 12 years after the first book. And the Holy War is already completed, and Paul is cemented as emperor, and it's kind of about Paul's new life as an all-powerful emperor, his marriage to Princess Arulin, and kind of all those things. So it's almost a new beginning, but you really don't see the Holy War in Dune Messiah. So if you're excited for that, you may be a little disappointed to learn that.
That's interesting. That definitely doesn't turn my excitement off.
Yeah. Yeah, me neither. I mean, Denis Villeneuve can adapt it however he wants. I mean, it'll be curious how he made the first Dune like novel into two movies. He's saying that he's going to do this one and it'll just be one to kind of cap it all off. Like, how does he adapt it? Does he include that stuff? Does he not? But yeah, either way, I mean, he's involved. He says he's going to direct it, so I don't give a shit. But yeah, that would be interesting just to kind of skip that and kind of see how the whole Messiah nature works after that. Yeah, we'll see what happens.
I'm kind of more excited a little bit too, because Paul is just such a fascinating character. So to see him as we saw him in this movie, kind of a kid at the start of the first one who has to grow up very quickly and then becomes a Messiah figure, and then to see him as an all-powerful emperor. Like, we don't see a whole lot of the emperor in this movie. No. And so to have a whole movie focused on a galactic emperor, I think will be pretty cool.
And just kind of the nature of ascending to the throne is also interesting. I mean, in this movie, they did, you know, I mean, they basically introduced Lea Seydoux into this movie just to kind of end it with her getting pregnant with Fade Rotha's kid. And now that like the three kind of heads of the Harkonnen family are dead, with Vladimir, Glossu, Rabin, and Fade Rotha, the person that would take up the mantle of the Harkonnen family would presumably be a child of one of them. So I do wonder how Fade Rotha's child could factor into the emperor conversation, or at least just a villain for Paul, maybe as like the new head of the Harkonnen family. I don't know.
Well, and also don't forget, Paul's sister is still out there and Paul is a Harkonnen. So they tease that in this movie, but I'm really curious to see what that means for his future too. And also, Leto Atreides says Stellan Skarsgård's character is his cousin. So that means they are marrying within the bloodlines, I guess, a little bit.
I guess so.
Kind of inbred. Some universe inbred.
Hey, get out of here.
Can't do that. I am curious, you know, with what we got in the last sequence with Shawnee walking away, you know, where is this going to leave the Fremen's 12 years later? Are they going to be still, are they still going to be all in on Paul being the one? We also get the fact that the other houses have turned down the recognition of him being the emperor at that point. So I do hope we do get some sort of explanation, I guess, from the past 12 years, how the Holy War does go down and what leads him to be the emperor at the end.
It's going to be interesting, too, because the Fremen have been largely sympathetic characters in Dune Part 1 and Part 2. But if they are now an army spreading out across the galaxy, forcing other people to accept their messiah, it's going to be interesting to see how that kind of twists. Like, do they become more evil as a society, too?
And them making it to the promised land, you know, Arrakis embracing its old name of Dune or whatever and kind of becoming this, you know, the green that they talk about or whatever you want to call it. Do they find that and then immediately get wiped out because everybody hates them now or something? Like, there could be some weird kind of a back and forth there as well. But I do think it is key to know, like, again, Austin clearly knows Dune Messiah, kind of like the idea, the premise, and some details going on there. But in terms of, like, an adaptation that Villeneuve would make, I have to imagine that Chani would play a bigger role in that.
And Chani is the one character he changed from the original book. So in the first book, Chani accepts the marriage of Paul and Princess Aurelian. They have their marriage and title only, but then Paul and Chani continue their relationship kind of in secret. And so that was the big change that Denis Villeneuve made, was he made Chani kind of her own character and had her descent from Paul at the end of this.
And, she's the final shot of the movie. So I don't think there's any reality where Dune Messiah, like, comes out and she's not maybe even the co-lead again. So I'm curious how he might continue to play out that character. And Paul says eventually, you know, she'll understand as time goes on. Like, will she? I'm curious. So, yeah, very, you know, very excited for a part three. It sucks that now I have to wait a while for it.
Yeah, it is. I'm curious, too. Like, will Chani become the one that has to lift the Fremen out of tyranny? Like, will she have to be the one that rebels against Paul and maybe save her people? Because that is another part of the prophecy, too. And she believes it has to be a Fremen that does that. So maybe it's her. I was also reading this week that Denis Villeneuve said Florence Pugh's character will be in part three, what he did with Zendaya in this one. So definitely a lot more screen time for Florence Pugh as well.
Which I'm excited about. You know, they've talked about the HBO show, which from what I understand, I think is filmed. The show that's like a 10,000-year prequel that focuses on the Bene Gesserit. And based on how they talked about the Bene Gesserit and their eugenics in this movie, my assumption will be that show will somehow be about the initial idea of their prophet, how they start breeding, whether it be the Harkonnens or the Atreides family, to eventually, you know, thousands and thousands of years later get to this point. But anyway, that show is filmed, so we know we're getting that prequel series. We know Dune Messiah, based on the money, is probably going to happen. And like we already said, we know Denis Villeneuve has said very clearly that, you know, I'm done after Messiah. That will be the end of my trilogy. But not only has he said that, he has said, I don't think there is any point in adapting anything beyond that. But we also know how Hollywood works.
Warner Bros. Wants their money, baby.
Right. There's so many more novels that Frank Herbert wrote and also his son wrote after
there's like 25.
There's so many. and like I said, Dune is a series that is lauded for its first book. And from what I understand, it jumped the shark almost immediately, and it's not a long-running franchise that I would say is very respected. I think it's largely considered to be not good as it goes on. So I'm curious, I mean, based on the money, do you guys – what do you hope for? Do you hope that we get that Dune Messiah, that's the end of a trilogy, maybe we get this prequel series, maybe you get another series along the way? Or are you kind of anticipating that this is going to become, you know, maybe in the future, 20 years from now, we go – we're talking about like Marvel now, Star Wars now. Will it become that eventually? Where it's just like, holy shit, there's so fucking many of these. But goddamn, didn't it start strong? Like, what do you guys think?
I will say 100% there's no way Warner Bros. Is ending this after Dune Part 3. And can you imagine being the director that has to step up like after Denis Villeneuve?
I was thinking about that this weekend. Like, who the fuck do you
get? There's one man that would do it. And his name is Michael Bay. Michael Bay, in a heartbeat, would say, I will sign up for your Dune franchise, whatever you need me to do. I don't have the integrity. Or Zack Snyder. Zack Snyder would probably do it, too. Zack Snyder would be like, I can do it better than Denis.
Zack Snyder's literally trying to do it now with a Rebel Moon. I didn't even watch that. And that means he can get Jason Momoa to come back.
He'll be the main character. It'll just be called Duncan.
Duncan. Oh, God. But yeah, I mean, I'm kind of with you, Austin. I kind of feel like it's going to be Denis is done after three, and then they keep making him, and you just see Denis Villeneuve's name pop up as an executive producer. And it's that thing that we always see. It's like, that guy didn't do anything with this, but he started it, so you got to put their name there so that they get paid. But I'm kind of nervous about the future of this beyond Messiah. And also, to your point, I was thinking the same thing. Like I said, like, I don't know who you get to make a movie that even, like, resembles what Denis Villeneuve's doing here. So I'm kind of nervous about that, but I'm just content with what will be a trilogy and maybe, like, a couple prequel series along the way. I think we're going to be happy at the end of the day.
I mean, a perfect trilogy is also hard to do. So yeah. If Denis nails that, I mean, that's an accomplishment in its own right, regardless if he steps away or regardless of who steps in after. But man, this second movie paired with the first movie is just already such an incredible journey.
I concur. All right. Well, with that, I think talking about the future, and Paul sees all futures, but that's the one that we're trying to figure out, of Dune. Let's close out, guys. Before we do that, let's do some Arnie's Podcast Awards, the part of our show where we take something positive, negative, or something in between from the movie, TV show, or whatever it is that we just talked about, and we give it an award. Doesn't matter what it is. It just comes from the heart. There's passion behind it. So, guys, what do you think gets an award today?
I'm going to give the George Lucas Had No Original Ideas Award. And Keith, you always talk about this, but there's a lot of, like, people drinking green goo and blue liquids in Star Wars. And turns out, even that's not an original idea, because they did it in Dune. The water of life is some blue liquid from an alien space creature. George Lucas truly had no original ideas.
Yeah, you can almost give the, what's the award I always get, the Sour Milk Award, which is always blue milk, green milk. I'm going to give the Best Mud Bath Award to Baron. That mud bath looked kind of disgusting, but it really seemed to help him. Like, he was in bad shape after the first movie, and he got a lot better.
Keith, even a Bacta tank was inspired by the mud bath. I mean, come on, George, what are you doing?
Yeah, so you could almost give, like, the Jabba the Hutt Award as well to Baron, because it pretty much just copied everything from that going into Tatooine with the back to tanks.
My award is going to be a simple one. It's just going to be the Mistakes All Around Award, and it goes to Dave Bautista as Rabin, a member of the Harkonnen family that we talked about. You know, he did some good work in the past. He was a big part of why the Harkonnens were beloved when it became to spice production. But then, you know, after the Emperor's plans, as we talked about, he tries to go back to his old job. Turns out he just, you know, he doesn't have that spry nature that he once did, and he can't do it anymore. But I was just laughing at all the mistakes this character made along the way. Like, even down to, like, the small things of, like, him walking into the room whenever Fade Rotha gets there for the first time, and he's just like, what are you doing here? Just gets his fucking shit rocked. I also think it was a big mistake that his weapon of choice is a whip. Whenever somebody that apparently has a vendetta against you, that aka Josh Brolin, comes up to you to fight, I don't think pulling out a whip as your means to fight somebody with a sword is the best move. And since that fight lasted quite literally 2.5 seconds, I think I'm right in saying that was a mistake.
Dude, Josh Brolin, he's looking good with long hair. He should keep that look.
All right. You know, I'll email him.
All right. Let him
best
know.
Hair award?
That's our secondary award. It's just like, got to keep that hair up. I like it. All right. Well, with that, thank you all so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure you hit that follow button so you never miss our upcoming content. Also, please share us with your friends if you enjoyed this episode. We really would appreciate that to continue to grow our show. Please leave us reviews as well. Even if you don't write anything, leaving us a 5-star review over on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcasts really does help us out. At the Arnie's is our social, and the Arnie's.media is the website. We'll be back next Tuesday with another episode.
And also, last week, if you want to take a journey with me and Matt, if you want to leave the deserts of Arrakis and go to the frozen tundras of Alaska, Matt and I sat down and broke down the finale of True Detective Night Country. So if you want to hear our thoughts on that and the season overall, be sure to go check that episode out.
And lastly, we want to hear from you. So please send us a message on Instagram at the Arnie's or email us thearniesmedia@gmail.com. What did you think of Dune Part 2? Would you stick your hand in a sandworm for $5? Anything you say, we'll read on the show and react to it live on our latest episode.
That's right, everybody. Hope you enjoyed this one. I know this was dense, almost as dense as the Dune movies themselves, but hope you enjoyed it. Hope you got something out of it. I hope you enjoyed the movie. And yeah, have a great rest of your week, and we'll see you next time. And I guess as we close out, guys, I can't believe I didn't ask, but Keith Sinus reminded me, did anybody get the Dune popcorn bucket where you had to stick your hand inside of a sandworm?
I did not, unfortunately. I was hoping I would, but...
Nothing I love better than sticking my hand through some plastic tubes to reach for a handful of buttery, sticky popcorn. All right, everybody. On that note, we'll see you next time. Have a good one.
See ya.
Paul finally got his desert power.
Desert power!